our city council meeting, the meeting of Cedar Hills City Council on July 20th, 2021. We are beginning at 7:00 PM. This meeting is being held live located at the Recreation Center in Cedar Hills. Our pledge this evening will be given by Councilmember Geddes, and it will be shortly given by Councilmember Smith.
All right, for the audience, please rise. You have me. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you.
Our Heavenly Father, we're grateful for this opportunity we have to gather as council members and residents and staff and discuss the needs of our city. Please bless us that as we do that, we will be mindful of all of our residents and of what will benefit our city the most, and that we will have discussions that are respectful and that are informative, and we will be guided by you in making decisions that are best for the city. We are grateful to live in this land and for the city that we live in, and thank you for being here with me tonight. Thank you.
All right, we'll go to our next item, which is the approval of the evening agenda.
I move that we want to check the ways. I move that we approve the July 20th, 2021 amended agenda as stated.
Thank you. So a motion by Councilmember Geddes, do I have a second?
I'll second.
Thank you, Councilmember Smith, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, that the agenda is approved. We're going to move on to public comment question. Do I have that question?
No way.
What?
No way.
Nobody signed up for public comment? Okay, thank you, Greg. Is there anybody here who would like to make a public comment that didn't sign up? Mr. Lepe, you would like to make a public comment?
Yeah, I didn't see the sign up sheet, sorry.
Okay, yeah, it's just always at the that table there.
Back there, okay.
You're fine.
Yeah, you're fine. Come on up. You've got, I have a new timer. Hopefully it works.
Okay.
So, come on, state your name. Oh, okay. State your name, address, and then you've got 3 minutes.
Thanks. Charles Loveday. Everyone knows me as Chuck. And 4306 West Harvey Boulevard. So, this week I saw something that interested me. Word of drought. Didn't know that. That's a joke. If you haven't heard drought 3,000 times in the last 15 years. So we live in a desert state, drought, right? Water use is such a big deal. So I was watching this program on Fox 13, I think it was, and they talked about water use. And so I looked it up in the U.S. Geological Survey and to see how the water was used. And I know in our city newsletter that I get, this most recent one here, you know, suggests that we use, you know, restrict our water usage. And I get that, water drop, and I agree with that. And especially pressurized irrigation. So my thoughts on this are, so we, you know, we have, you know, and on the website it suggests we take shorter showers and don't wash your house with a hose and stuff like that. Which I get. We should all conserve water in a desert state in a drought condition for the last, what, 10 or 15 years. But the thing that caught my interest was that in Utah, we use 21 million gallons per day to water golf courses. And in a drought state, that just, I don't know, that seemed a lot to me. It's a small percentage, but the millions of gallons. The average U.S. Person in Utah uses 167 gallons a day. So I started doing the math, and it just, you know, if you're in Canada, I'm from Canada, and you need to live near Great Slave Lake, you could water every golf course in the U.S. 24 hours a day. But we don't have that water here. And so how do we, I'm sure there's in discussion about this, how do we lower the usage for, you know, golf courses, which actually, you know, 5% of the citizens use, and 95% subsidize. You know, there's a lot of interest in reducing personal use, but haven't we thought about that? And again, to, you know, be redundant, last year 250 municipal golf courses like ours closed for many reasons. A lot of them have to do with the water, and had to do with usage, and they never made money. So my question is, have we considered that? Also, my last question, I've got 20 seconds left, is the budget that was discussed in the last council meeting, was approved, right? So we're moving ahead with that budget, meaning we're spending the money on the golf course, redesigning the golf course, building the putt-putt golf course. I don't know how city government works, except that I've been to two council meetings. Was that budget approved, and if so, is that what's going to go on?
Thank you. On our agenda today is that item.
That item? Okay. Great. So we'll talk about that. Okay.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay. Thank you. So I will close the public comment portion of the meeting, and we'll move on to the reports of business. And we'll start with Mr. Hagan, the city manager report.
Thank you. Let me report on golf. We have had a pretty successful year the last 2 years, and it seems to be our trend right now. So they're off to a great start for the new fiscal year. Golf has actually seen a rise in popularity, and we've been the beneficiary of that popularity as we've seen our rounds of golf played on the course increase significantly, and I'll get into that in our presentation tonight. We have some recreation programs that are getting ready to kick off this fall. We have flag football, team flag football, K through second grade soccer, and taught soccer is open right now for registration. We have a rec department job opening for to be a rec manager. So if you have more information, please still see the website. If you know somebody who might be interested, send them our way. We're really wanting to hire somebody. We have a bowling league this summer that's been a great hit. We had 44 kids participating. We're grateful for our partnership with Jack and Jill Bowling. And in other programs, we've had school science class and Lego camps open for registration for right now for the fall, and we're excited about those offerings. And we've started something new this year in terms of summer camps. You might be seeing groups of kids out here on in Heritage Park. They were a huge hit. We got a lot of good feedback asking we sent out a survey to the participants asking what we did, what they thought went well, what they thought we could improve on. We feel like this would be a great program that we can really develop in the coming years. As we approach the 24th of July weekend, we want everyone to still be safe. We had a great 4th of July weekend in terms of firework safety. We want to ask residents to continue that for this next weekend. And then finally, the ballots for the primary election went out today. So you should be seeing those in the mail, in your mailbox in the next couple days.
I just wanted to remind people that we're still taking YCC applications until the end of the month. So that's for 9 to 12 graders. And if you live in the city, and it's a really unique opportunity to serve the city and do leadership skills. And so we're excited for anybody who wants to apply and be getting started now. We have 12 applications. We have more than that now.
Yeah, we have more options ready. I'm glad for that.
Okay, great. All of my committees took July off, so I didn't have any meetings other than these meetings, as much as usual. So that was great. So I actually don't have anything to report. So, that's great. That's good. That's really fast. All right, move on to our scheduled items and public hearings, and our first item in that section is a review action on conceptual plan for modifications to the golf course and creation of a golf short course. Mr. Goodwin.
Okay, thank you, Mayor and Council. I wanted to take a minute to make sure everyone understood how we got here tonight to make this decision. All right, so give me just a few minutes to really go back in time and help everyone understand where we are. when the course was built, you can look over there, you can see those big steel poles that are 50 feet coming out of the ground. They're actually 62-foot poles. All of the design was approved on. They're 62-foot poles. They go up 50 feet, and they're every approximately 45 feet. You can see the design here. Well, when the course was originally built, they were built with 35-foot wooden poles. And at the time, that was adequate because there were no homes right there. The road that's there was not in service, so there weren't cars that could be there. There wasn't a trailer. It was just nothing. So 35 feet was completely adequate. In 2011, we had our first home that went in over there in the cul-de-sac. And from that point, we started getting calls saying, hey, you've got golf balls coming over the fence. So in 2013, I believe it was, we raised the first five sections over there from 35 feet to 50 feet, still with poles. That was fine for a little bit. It addresses some of the problem, not all of it. And balls are still going. But as the development continued to occur, as this road out there became a little more heavily traveled, as people began to use the trail, they began to use the parking, started getting more complaints. So the city in 2016, we had raised the remainder of those nets to 50 feet, still with poles. In 2018, we had a nice storm that froze over the net, and the winds blew over the poles. I don't remember that. It was Martin Luther King Day. It's really cold, the wind just snapped those poles like they're twigs. A few of them came down, so we were worried that whole things would come down. So we got out there, Greg and Jeff were out there, we snapped those lines and let the poles fall where they may. At that point, we haven't had a ton of complaints, but at that point, we felt like 50-foot poles were adequate. So rather than going through a professional study, we just said, let's replace the 50-foot poles, and let's put in steel poles, let's put in something that's gonna last. And that's where you get the design you have here today. From that time, the neighbors saw us putting in the 50-foot steel poles, and they immediately said, what are you doing? Why didn't you go higher? And staff's point was, well, we didn't know. Like, I didn't know what they were doing. I didn't know the scope of the issue. We felt like it was out of it. We did a golf ball study where we had our car kids that worked for us every night, where we would have them count how many buckets were sold that day, and we'd log it in a spreadsheet, and then they'd have kids go walk on the outside of that fence and gather every ball that they could, whether they found them. They'd count whether they found them just over the fence on that hillside adjacent to the fence, it's still the city's property, or whether they found them in the road, or in the park, or in the adjacent neighbor's property. And they kept track of that. We did that for, was that 6 weeks, Greg?
No, a lot like that. Probably 12 weeks.
Probably is a while. And what we estimated that we were losing about 3% of balls. But when you have hundreds of balls being hit, even sometimes thousands of balls being hit in a day, 3% adds up, especially with over time. That's why we had Mr. Carr, who lives there, came in one day for a council meeting with a lot of balls. There's probably a couple thousand that he alone brought in that night. So we began to think, okay, well, what would adequate netting look like? So we hired we hired somebody to come out and look at our netting, to look at our netting and say, what would be adequate, what should we see there? And this is what the proposal looked like. For scale, you can see that they proposed a fence that ran the entire length of, or the entire perimeter of the driving range. Similar to what you can see at Topgolf. And you can see, for scale, these orange poles, that's our poles. So quite a bit larger. They recommended that we go up to 130 feet. So if you look out there and say, okay, that's 50, that's 130 feet, but that's pretty big. And they actually recommended encompassing, like I said, the entire length. But where we're seeing the problem is balls being driven from the base of the driving range and then going over the fence into this intersection and park into Long Common Drive and along this trail. So the estimated cost on this is $1.3 million. And what we found over the years, and firmly believe this, that as the technology in golf has improved, it's made up for shortcomings in players' games, where they are able to hit a little bit farther than they used to, hit a little bit faster than they used to. I believe if you look at the average length of a PGA Tour drive, 10 years ago, 15 years ago versus today, Greg, I'm going to put you on the spot. How has it changed?
Dramatic.
Dramatic? It's a lot. People used to not hit over 300 yards very frequently. Now it's quite common. So people, balls are going farther. So the netting that was even designed, you know, 15 years ago, of course, is not what it would be adequate. We're saying this would be adequate right now, but I met with a gentleman today who said he goes to Topgolf with his son-in-law and he watches his son-in-law smack the ball over, intentionally smack the ball over that fence, and that fence is like 160 to 170 feet. So that's where we are. We did this trajectory study and thought, oh my goodness, that's a lot of money. To not make sure that every ball goes over, to make sure that the marginal ball, that last ball, cannot go over the fence, you almost have to just enclose the range. So we looked at a number of options as a staff. We really tried to brainstorm where can we go with this. And we talked about limiting it to irons only versus drivers only. And that was part of the study for a few weeks in the summer. We said no drivers, only irons. And we still see a lot of we still saw a lot of balls going over the fence. We changed the angle rather than hitting straight down the fairway, we angled them a little bit to northeast, right? So they were aiming this way. And I think it reduced the number of balls slightly, but it put everyone playing on 18 at risk. So then in order to fix that, we have to still put up nets, but these ones right here. We're just moving the problem somewhere else. We talked about switching the driving range to go the opposite direction. We felt like this would probably cost prohibitive in that we have to regrade everything here, we have to put tee boxes here, we have to put a cart path over here, not to mention that it's quite a long ways for people to go to use the driving range. So we felt like that probably wouldn't solve the problem either. Also, you can still put the ball right over the fence if you have a nasty left hand. So we kind of were at an impasse here. So I want to just say that we looked at a lot of options. We've had a number of discussions with council about this. If you've been on council for a number of years, Councilman Geddes, you can attest that we talked this one quite a bit. So let me talk real quickly about the financials of the course. In 2009, when the course was still in its infancy, green fees brought in $541,000, and the range brought in $25,000. So you can kind of see the ratio of green fees to range fees. So 541 to 25. In 2013, it was 555 to 23,000. So a very similar ratio about 5 years later. In 2019, it was 572 to 21, so one was trending a little bit upwards and one was trending down. And this year, we budgeted 702 for green fees and 29 for range fees. So one has trended up quite significantly faster than the other one, which made me want to go look at what's happening with our range in terms of play. Basically, how many rounds of golf are we selling for one bucket of balls? So I went back with a bit of the data I had. This is 1 year. So you can see in the month of July 2020, we did 13,379 rounds of golf, 714 buckets. That came out to about just under 5%, so about 1 in 20. And you can see that 1 in 20 ratio holds true almost the entire year. Sometimes it fluctuates up. People want to come break off the rust early in March, so it goes up to 8% here. But really, if you look at the number of total people, it's because there's really not many people using the course.
The other significant, the difference about those ones is that's when the high school teams play, and they increase dramatically.
That makes sense. So looking at it on a year-to-year basis, FY fiscal years 2017 to 2021, you can see that this 5% holds fairly true, 120. So you can see the total number of rounds played each year, and you can see the buckets sold at the range. This includes 18 and 9 holes of golf, and this includes large and small baskets of golf balls. So the way that I'm interpreting this is that there are many people that like our range. There are more people that really like our course. I don't feel that people come here because of the range. I think if people want to go hit balls at a nice range, they go to Fox Hollow. And that's not a dig on our range, it just is not built, it's not constructed like the range should be. So let me get into the description of what we're proposing tonight. There's two proposals, and I'm going to start with the second one, because it's not the one I'm going to recommend. But this is the second proposal we got from John Foyt. He's the golf course architect out of Arizona that we contracted with. He's done a number of municipal courses all around the country. He did, for reference, he did the Alpine Country Club, their renovations. And beautiful courses. He was mentioned in the Deseret News as they held the amateur championships at Alpine Country Club wrapped up last week. They were specifically mentioned designed by John Foyt. He's got a great reputation. But he came out and said, I'm going to look at everything. I'm going to look at your range. And he said, first of all, let me just tell you, your range is not designed after me. It's not wide enough, it's not long enough, and your nets are not tall enough, especially where you have a road and you have a park and you have a trail. He said, now we can't put a range in here. So this is an aerial shot of Holy TV. You can see the pond that's there. You can see this pump house that's right there. It's that white building just through the window there. You can say, okay, we can build a range here. We have to take almost all the team to do it. We'd have to move the irrigation pond. And the plus side of this is we could really build a nice irrigation pond, something really deep. It requires to move the pump house. It requires to move the pond. And it requires us to do quite a bit of extensive earthwork on this project. He did not give us an estimate of this, what this would cost, but I'm assuming it's a couple million dollars.
Two X.
Yes. Not an exact number, but high enough for me. The problem this creates, though, when you want to say we have to create a driving range, is that if you do it this way, you now have 17 hole golf courses. So you have to find a place to build a 17 hole, and there's or an 18 hole, excuse me. So there's two places that we thought of. There was the U.S. Forest Service land is down next to the bottom line, which we would have to work out an agreement with the federal government. So that sounds like it would take a moment or two. And then there's reconfiguring St. Andrews, which is adjacent to Canyon Road, and it's the big. It used to be the big Park 5 when the course originally opened. That was done away with. The course was reconfigured. Do what we have right now. We configured 18, and anyway, we'd be going back and redoing that. But what that is you also have an opportunity cost for that, in that when they reconfigured the golf course, they plotted that 22, I believe, the paper lots. So that's an asset that sits on the city's books right now, is that we have a little subdivision there that at some point the city could decide to sell and do something more. But if you have to put a hole there, you have to pay at least $1 million to develop a hole, and you're walking away from that opportunity cost as well. So you can kind of gather what the total cost would be to the city.
Well, it's not only future revenue to the city, but it could be future public land for the city. I mean, there's no reason that we have to put houses there.
No, and that's exactly, to your point, that's exactly why there's no houses there right now, is because the council is not convinced that they want to see houses there. You know, there's been talk about doing a park or doing something else there.
It's a dog park.
It's a dog park. I don't know where we're going to drag the deer and store them after they're not picked up if they get rid of that. So this was option two. And I think by and large, Councilmember Smith, Councilmember Geddes, Berenson, we were all there with the meeting. By and large, we looked at this option and said, this isn't going to work. So let me go to range concept one. That's not it. So it's taking what is there and it's making it a short course. It's an executive six-fold short course. What it includes is as you come down the path here toward the driving ranges, this first hole will be elevated. So you have two tee boxes here that drive to a hole, which is, this is, you can see, it's 100 yards. This next hole, 210 yards. Hole 3, 60 yards. Hole 4, 80 yards. Hole 5, 90 yards. And hole 6, 78 yards. So, Councilmember Geddes, I'm going to put you on the spot. If you're going to golf this, what club would you use?
So I'd probably bring just two clubs, a putter and a fish wedge.
Yeah, I think that's most people's approach to this. Some people might bring a 9-iron, but you would not see anything. I'm going to say this, but I'm going to stand by this. But you should not see anything being hit on this course that has the potential to go over and hit homes there.
Right. Although 9-iron or 8-iron could get high.
To get high, it's not going to go far, right? So, I've met with people, I met with Mr. Rotita, who's the original homeowner that's there about this, and I stand by the tape that if balls are being hit over the fence in this scenario, they're being hit with the intent to go over the fence. But in order to do this project, you have to do quite a bit of grading to shape the earth, make it look like a little golf course out there. You have to reposition the tees on hole 18 and move them forward so that these golfers aren't driving into the short course area. Additionally, it includes some improvements at the clubhouse. Mr. Foyt came out and immediately identified one of our major problems in the course is that our practice area, the putting green over here, is far, far too small for what a golf course should have. Not only that, but slopes. So you want a nice, big, flat area for a putting green for people to warm up. So it includes some great improvements up here at the clubhouse. In addition to moving these, cleaning up these tee boxes, if you go stand on those tee boxes, this is hole one, by the way. As you stand on hole one and you look at the tee boxes and you look at where they're aiming you, where they're pointing you, it looks like you're hitting onto the fourth fairway. And that's why so many balls, myself included, land on the fourth fairway. So it's making that a cleaner shot, making it clearer for the golfers. There are a number of golfers that want to warm up before they come golf. So we thought about a hitting net with 10 stations here where basically you have, it's 100 feet wide, and every 10 feet you have these mats that you hit off. And there's a net that's just, you know, what is it, 30 feet front?
I thought it was 10 feet.
Not far, it's hilarious. You're just hitting five balls, little bucket, and smacking the balls into this warm-up net there. The estimated cost on this is about $1 million. So it's a healthy amount of money, I will say that. In the budget that we approved on June 29th last month, we set aside $950,000 for golf course improvements. So I want to be clear that there's no proposal to do any debt service, there's no proposal to do any to raise property taxes to pay for these improvements. The city is in good financial health where we have spent a lot of time putting money into various places within the city where money needs to be spent. So if you look around the city, we spent quite a great deal of money on parks. Go down to the Harmon Park and see the fruits of the city's labor in terms of a beautiful park down there. We're talking about Heritage Park, reconstructed Bayview Park. Not only parks, we're talking, we've done roads. We started a bonded matrix project down some of our Medicaid capital roads. 4600 West and Harvey Boulevard are going to be coated with a bonded matrix, which should last for a long, long time. If you're curious about what that means, it's basically a layer of the road that goes down to the aggregate and makes the road last a lot longer. And if you do that early in the road's life, it actually extends the ride life of that road by a number of years. And so there's been attention paid to parks, to roads. Tonight we're talking, I think it's the final item, we're talking about water projects, utility projects. So in no way, shape, or form is the city focused solely on golf in terms of where it spends money, but the city has spent money all over the city. We had increased the amount a couple years ago that we went put towards library. We've increased the amount we put towards the family festival. We see that there's people and there's needs, there's desires that people have of their community, and we want to work with them. Part of the Heritage Park upgrades includes a lot of things, like my pens. I got water. But part of the Heritage Park improvements includes a lot of improvements to the amphitheater area where we host the Creekside Theater and the Youth Theater. So you know, we're looking at various areas of, okay, what makes my community great? We're not saying it's golf, we're not saying it's parks, but we're saying it's the aggregate of all of these items. We take care of our roads. We do have reliable utility systems. So money's been budgeted for this project. What we're asking for the council is that we give a review action and give staff a thumbs up to proceed with this project in the construction phase, to get construction drawings. The reason that being is that these golf companies that are constructing courses are now starting to book for next year. And so we want to address this problem. We want to get it done. And so now is the time. So we feel very confident in what this will be. Let me end with this. There's really nothing like this in our area in North Utah County. The only one I could find in Utah County was the East Bay. They have a seven-hole, it's called an executive course. So remember the range revenues. They were roughly $25,000 per year. So by our calculations, at $6 a round, groups going out every 10 minutes, every 15 minutes, you can see what the total revenue would be. This assumes full transparency. This assumes 100% of the tee times are being used. So you're not going to get that. But what happens when it's 25% of the tee times? Let's say that two people go out every hour, three people go out every hour. This is what you would look like. This is what your revenue would look like. 25% of those rates. Finally, let me end with this. I wasn't going to share this, but it happened just right before I came to council. I went to pick up my son from basketball, and he said, "Dad, I want to go golfing." I cannot take my son and teach him on this course. It is way too hard, and I'm too cheap to take him somewhere else. But to me, this is a great opportunity for people to learn golf. There was an email that the council received, honestly, maybe 2 months ago, where somebody said, "I want to see more opportunities for golf in the community where people can come and learn how to golf." And that is really how I envision this. You can learn on a range. You can go run through all the clubs and hit them all. I understand that. But this gives them an opportunity to go and walk, to approach the hole, to aim for the hole. This is an opportunity for me to bring my son out and teach him how to golf. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have, any thoughts. Mayor, Councilor Smith, you guys were there as part of that meeting. I would encourage you. I'd love to hear your thoughts on what you saw, and kind of where you're leaning, and answer any questions.
Sure. So, what's his first name?
Liam. My son or
John?
John.
John.
Liam's my favorite person.
John's the one
I'm talking about. I saw Liam. But John Boyd.
Boyd, yes.
Yeah, John Boyd. So we met with him a couple of weeks ago last week. Anyway, I felt like it was a good meeting. He has a lot of good ideas. And my, you got maybe too detailed on it. My take on this was, I feel like this asset we have as a golf course, besides just the beauty of it, and there's a lot of people that don't golf in our community that absolutely tell me, you know, I don't golf, but I sure love the beauty of the golf courses. I love the walkthrough, I love the scene, I love the open space. And, you know, I get that a lot. So, but I'm a golfer. So, my take on this was, how do we get more people in our community involved in golf? And interestingly enough, I met with like two families that I had no idea. They have young kids, and they all have them first time. They decided this summer that they're going to start golfing. And these kids are like, you know, preteens. And the dad says, I'm not really a golfer, but I take my kids up there, put them on the range. You know, I'm trying to give them lessons and all this sort of stuff. I feel like for our community, this is a tremendous opportunity for us to give golf more to the masses. And like you said, we have a fairly difficult course. I mean, it's known as being a fairly difficult course. But this will be a very simple place where you can go out and spend 45 minutes with your kid. Like you say, aim at it and a pin, learn golf etiquette. There's a lot of things in golf that are really cool. I mean, it is a very popular sport, and it has gone up in our neighborhood exponentially. And you can't deny that the golf, our rounds of golf have gone like through the roof.
Yes.
And our golf course is very busy compared to how it was.
How many years ago?
12 years ago?
40.
Yeah, 12.
Yeah, it's been almost 18 years.
Okay, so since I first hit a golf ball number one, long before I was on the council, I had a season pass at the golf course every single year before I paid for a season pass. I have a son that worked here from the time he was 10 till the time he left for college, and then he came back every summer and worked, and because of that, my three sons all enjoy the game of golf. And so it's a big thing for me personally, but I personally would like to share that experience with other families. And I think this is money that's spent. We spend money on our other assets in our community. And, you know, I don't use every park. And a lot of people don't use the golf course, and I understand that. But it's something it's an asset to the community, and I think this is a good opportunity for us to spend reasonable money. I think we set it aside, we're not raising taxes for it. We spend money on it. We've got a big placeholder in our budget next year for Eric Park to improve it, bring more courts, increase the Creekside Theater. I mean, that's all in Heritage Park, and I'm all for that. I've never been to the Creekside Theater, so I've never paid to watch the productions, but I hear they're really good. So, I think this is just one of those things. Obviously, I'm a golf course advocate, and there's a lot of people in my neighborhood that golf. I would say there's a tremendous amount of people that golf regularly in my community, in my specific neighborhood. So,
let me touch on something. I think I use this analogy in a discussion with the mayor, that if you think about the golf course like we think about every other asset we have in the city, that after time, you have to upgrade, you have to take care of it. This room is a great example that if you walk in this room 6 months ago, you would see a different look. And so staff felt like it's time to upgrade the look in this building, upgrade the feel. And that's done. And we got great reviews on that. So it builds our asset, it renews that asset. And we have to look at the golf course as an asset. Part of this is that we're also looking at other areas of the course. And so we're saying this is where we're going to start. And I imagine this being the biggest part of the golf course renovation. But part of it is looking at various areas of the course and saying, how do we make this course more playable, more enjoyable? We counted there's 42 bunkers on the course, and we just don't have the staff to maintain 42 bunkers. So Mr. Foyt is out here looking and saying, okay, out of your bunkers, you need to keep that one, let's get rid of these other ones, let's fill them in, let's position them so that they're actually more strategic, and let's make them look nice, so that our course, when people come and play our course, they have a great experience. Just like when we go to our park, we want them to have a great experience. So I think that's really the approach the staff's had on this project. I see this as a, like we did the Parks Master Plan. Like we have a capital facility, like we are pushing the event staff to say, you want to do renovations in the building? Let's put together a plan. We want to have a golf course capital plan where we plan these tax expenditures into the future so that we're not just shooting from the hip each year. We know exactly where we're going.
So, Chuck, you'll be back for you later.
Can we ask questions?
No.
We can't ask questions?
Not right now.
No. In a minute.
So this is a discussion for the council. You'll have some time for this. Oh, there's no public hearing. I think it might be incumbent on, I know Councilman Elford isn't here tonight, but he wrote a piece on it. And I think he posted it on the Seattle's chat room, or one of them. might be coming on a lot of people to read. I think you made a lot of good points. I don't know if you're still listening, but thank you, Ben, for what you said. And I think he said a lot of the same things you just said, but on the council position.
Councilmember Smith, do you have anything to add for me?
I was just impressed at the meeting. He definitely knows what he's doing. And I appreciated the other ideas that he gave us around the course instead of just concentrating on this one thing. He took the time to tell us some other things that we should look at. I agree with Mike on a lot of things. We do a lot of things in the city that we need to constantly look at and constantly improve. And I don't want to throw anybody under kind of the bus, but the range was not done well. It was done well for when it was done, when we didn't have houses, and we didn't have this, and we didn't have that, and it was done for its time, but it's kind of run its course. Not unintended. And so I think it's our job to look at, like, how do we make sure that we stay, just like this building, how do we stay relevant and get more people in here and ready? How do we get more people to enjoy this asset that we have that we are stuck with, right? So, like, the conversation about golf course, it tends to make this particular thing angsty when it really doesn't need to be. It's like anything else. You know, we spent $8 million over at Harvey, and nobody complained about it, and it makes us $0. And I have no children, and I don't go to Harvey. So, I sit around and complain about Harvey and talk about how I don't have any children and you just built a park for kids. So I think we need to recognize that we have a lot of needs in the city, we have a lot of responsibilities in the city, and that this particular thing will bring more people together and it will fix some problems that we had. And it's, I don't want to say $1 million isn't a lot of money, but in our budget and in the things that we do, it's not compared to some of the other things that we do, and we don't hear the same kind of pushback that we tend to hear from this. And so personally, I start to drown it out because it's just an old topic that we've been really seeing this day. So anyway, I think this is a great idea. I think it's a good move forward. I think it fixes a lot of things. I think it makes an asset more valuable. And I think that we spend a good amount of money in a lot of places, and that this is a good place to spend.
In full disclosure, you're not a golfer, right?
No, not a golfer. I've been out on the course once, so, to the
Well, I appreciate all the time. Yeah, this is something I've heard about since I went to the city, and I haven't been as aware as I've learned in the last 5 months. But I appreciate the plan to look at things outside the box, because we had an issue and it needed to be addressed. And I know we kept talking about homeowners and houses, but I think if you took a step back and looked at people's comments, I think it was more like people. It wasn't, I mean, houses, windows, things can be replaced, but when you've got 100 kids over here playing soccer and one of them could get hit by a ball, or you've got kids selling lemonade on the corner and they have balls flying over them. I mean, to me, it's that's what hits home for me. It's about safety and keeping our kids safe. I agree with you that this was built at a time when there wasn't even a road there. There's a road there now. We've got this park. And so I feel like this is a great way to use that space. I'm not a golfer. I never golf unless there's a map or a windmill at the end. And my husband wants me to go all the time, and I don't want to sit on the golf cart. But I might do this. This is appealing to me, and to take my son and to, you know, be out for just a little bit. So I'm happy with what you've presented with us, and I'm excited about it.
Can I add a few more things just to make sure that everything's on the record? I mentioned East Bay, they have a 7-hole executive course. That's the nearest thing to this in our area. They also have a driving range that they recently redid. Their driving range is probably 200 or 300 feet wide, and they should put up how high was that's very good.
Maybe 50 at that.
There's a smack dab in the middle of their course. There's nothing around it other than other corners. So I wanted to be clear about that. I did mention East Bay, they do have a driving range as well. The maintenance costs on this will require more maintenance costs. Right now they can go off on boarding and go off. So it is incumbent on the golf staff to really promote this and get successful with the passes. We need to, I believe that it can be financially much more successful than the range. But I do believe that golf needs to do their part to push it out to the public and promote it. I do think it'll take a few years to build up. I don't think it's just going to start.
How much does it cost to pay a play in this game? I haven't played that number of executive courses there where I want to
play. I don't know. Are you going to that?
$99.
Nine?
It was just renovated, so I'm not sure on the pricing. The one thing I would like to add, though, is with this new course, we would do the same with your golf course. You'd have a resident rate for senior resident versus a non, because they're the taxpayers.
We've also talked about different rates for youth and different rates for people to try to encourage younger kids to come play, and this would be a great area for them to play.
And that's my point. My point is it's a community thing for youth as well as adults. And I don't think we need to really, it's not that important that we make a lot of money. I think it's important that we cover our costs and that it gets more play by a broader range of people.
I do think that's a big part of it. Yes, I agree.
We also talked about hygiene clubs.
I mean, it's a little more true golf than going to Top Golf. No, because I've been there a number of times. It's fun. Brought my family, all my family that doesn't golf, my daughter-in-laws that don't golf. They backed away, and my wife backed away, and we got fun. But this is a little different.
Yeah.
It's a lot less expensive.
Well, let me try a few more things. I just want to make sure that I get everything off of my list here. We talked in the meeting about it being somewhat of a hybrid, that on tournament days, people can come get off these mats early in the morning. We talked about that. Golf staff does not like that idea. It is an option, it's on the table, but they don't like that idea simply because we already have a problem on the course where people they pitch onto the green and the ball comes down and makes a big divot in the green. And there's little tools you have that you pop that hole back up so that it doesn't kill that spot on the green. People are notorious for not fixing the divots and fixing their pock marks. So if you have people driving here, you have those pock marks all over these greens. So it really deteriorates.
You open up the course again. I mean, the driving range is the same issue we had, which you know, may or may not be fixed.
So there's that. We would get rid of this. You look out there, there's a putting area out there on the hillside. We'd get rid of that. That would go away. And then finally, to decrease the amount of vandalism, I think we owe a about a 6-foot chain-link fence that kind of ran along the property to make it a little more difficult for kids to just walk up inside. So I think that's all I have.
I have one quick question. You made a really good point about marketing and doing that. Does that fall on
the
staff? Does that fall on
Wade? The golf course works with Chase Marketing every year to push out their marketing materials. We've tried to think, we've done Groupon in the past, Valpak in the past. We've done them, just if they're successful, and walked away from them, and we feel like they're not worth the money we put into them. So they're continually marketing that. Every winter, Wade Doyle, our golf course manager, he puts together a business plan of how he intends to spend his advertising budget. He seeks out those corporate events, those tournaments that we get in. And I think last year we looked at the budget, we did just about $100,000 in tournaments. And that's something that gets people that may not normally come to our course, that gets them to come. And then the question is, if you've got people to come to our course, how do you get them to come back? Well, they have to have a good experience on that initial visit to us, they're not going to come back. So that's why what we do matters.
Along with that, though, I'll add that because of not having a driving range, that's going to affect our friends because people want a driving range. So that's part of the conversation and marketing plan, too, is letting them know up front, being honest, and just finding ways to still have a win-win.
So during a tournament, Greg, what percentage of people during a tournament use driving range?
Depends on the tournament. Sometimes they purchase the balls and every player gets to go over and hit them. Sometimes they individually do it. Every tournament is so different. But to Chandler's note, if we're going to do this, we would absolutely not have to be a director.
Right, and too much damage. Okay. All right, if we are finished with all of our comments, I will then look towards a motion for this item.
I make a motion that we approve the concept proposal based on upgrades to the golf course and direct staff to have construction documents prepared for bids.
Thank you, Councilmember Geddes, do I have a second? I'll second. Thank you, Councilmember Smith, will you roll call vote, Councilmember Geddes?
Aye.
Councilmember Smith?
Aye.
Councilmember Ellison?
Aye.
Thank you, that motion is passed. And we're going to move on to item number 7, review action and public hearing amendments to city code title 10-6A, which is landscaping in the SC1 commercial park.
We've been approached by river builders that want to have the city explore the landscape requirements in the commercial zone. Currently, the landscaping code in the SC1 zone requires 30% landscape. That includes sand, concrete, pavers, rock beds, flower beds, grass, trees, everything except basically sidewalks and streets and building. The 30% is actually quite high. And if you think about it, we sold 9 acres of commercial land to developers, and they're required to turn 3 of that back into park space. In the code, it talks about creating an atmosphere where there's plazas and fountains and things of that nature. And if you put in a plaza and a fountain, you can get a reduction down to 25%. I think that this code was drafted with the best intentions, but don't know that we're ever going to see a plaza or a fountain that way. But
we have one on our park, right?
We have a compound, it's a space now. So, so what we're proposing is that we allow for a reduction in landscape requirement from 30 to 23 contingent upon a that the plans may be reduced no less than 23% of any improved site in the event that the developer provides a monetary contribution towards landscaping efforts in Cedar Hills. And I would specifically say that it should probably be in the commercial zone, because that's what we're trying to enhance. In order to calculate this contribution, an approved landscaping plan with a cost estimate per square foot shall be provided to the city. The cost estimate shall be used to calculate the dollar value that the developer may choose to pay to make other landscaping improvements throughout the city. The developer shall determine the square footage difference between the 30% required landscaping and the proposed landscaping plan. And the square footage amount should be multiplied by 1.5, the estimated cost of landscaping per square foot to determine the contribution to the city. So, with that being said, we've talked in the city about water conservation. We're going to talk more about water conservation later this week. But what we talked about is taking some of these areas and reducing the need for watering in areas that we identify as not being really usable for the public. Namely, when you walk down 4600 in front of Charleston, there's a median strip. Inside that, there's the grass bed. We've let it die because we're planning on taking it out and putting in some pavers. And I recognize that the pavers have a different look than grass, but one of the major complaints that we get every year and a number of times about the community is that our sprinklers are on the spring of the street. It's always on these little park strips that are in the middle. They're not on timers. Sorry, they're on timers. They're not on sensors. But no one is raining. And so whenever it rains, it always rains when those are on. So to get out of there, I'll just need to run it. But this would allow us to combine these two efforts, the interest of the developer in terms of reducing the landscaping requirement, giving them more commercial space to develop, while at the same time allowing us to look at ways that we can use that contribution to the city to reduce our watering requirements in the SLO commercial zone. So with that being said, I'd love to answer any questions you guys have about the plan.
So you mentioned efforts, landscaping efforts in the commercial zone, but...
Yeah, I would propose that the code be amended to... In my conversations with Mr. Hall, we want to create a nexus between the requirement and the use. And So we can then say, well, we find that it's important that commercial zone has certain steps up to it. And that's why the money is spent in commercial zone, because we're going to make this money go towards that step.
So I'm just trying to figure out how that works. You were going to put in 30%, it was going to cost you $50,000. Now you're going to put in 20%. So now you're going to use, that's going to cost you $20,000. So the $10,000 you get put into city stoppers.
No, it's based on square footage. So let's say you have 10,000 square feet, and that's the requirement that you reduce it down to 7,000 square feet. Mm-hmm. Right, so it's a 3,000 square foot difference.
And the 7,000 per square foot costs you so much per square foot. Now the 3,000 you're not doing.
Yeah, so it'd be 1.5 that 3,000. That's, that creates a, you have to, you can't, it can't be arbitrary increases in that. I like you, so it's going to only be this much. There's a formula you can rely on that says this is how we calculate.
Well, that's what I was worried about. I can see the developer wanting that work, but you could say, okay, my estimated cost for my landscaping was X. Now it's not the actual amount of the difference. But he could put that cost down way low, so that this X one one is extra. X, one times X 1.5 would be.
So the way to get around that or mitigate that is that the landscaping plan has to be accompanied by an estimate from a landscape engineer or a landscape architect. And then I'm not reviewing that. I can send that to Bowen Collins, but they have landscape architects. I gotta say, this is a fair price. This is a fair market.
Right.
So it there's a check and balance.
So it's not arbitrary. But I'm also thinking, I'm kind of looking, I was thinking of some of the things that could be enhanced in the commercial zone. So one of the things initially I thought would be, she said, well, how do you spend it in the commercial zone? Well, you can upgrade from a 1-inch caliper tree to a 3-inch caliper tree. So all of a sudden you have a little more mature tree that goes in and written initially, and the bigger trees are much more expensive. That's the kind of stuff you're thinking
about. You could very well dump it back into the site itself and say, we want you to use this money to buy bigger trees.
Yes.
Other areas are the roundabout. You can say, well, we want to see more permanent lighting on the roundabout.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the commercial zone, and you can say, well, we can do anything we want out there. Because this is the goal. We want to.
I totally agree. The space is arbitrary. So, but not the value, but the quality of the space is really more important than just the space. Right?
Yes.
I didn't like that 30%. I always thought that was way too high personally, but whatever, 35%. 30?
It's 33.
Not 23. Close. I think that's totally fair.
So there's a public hearing here, sir.
Yeah, I just want to see if Councilor Rivers has any comments about that, and then we'll open that to a public hearing. No?
The only thing I wanted to mention is that there is a park strip kind of reimbursement program that states you think it's not coming to town yet. If we approve this, there might be people who want to wait until fall if they want to.
This is for residential properties?
Oh, this is just for residential. Okay. Yeah. Residential one. I'm sorry. No, this is all commercial. Okay. Great. We're going to move on and open this up to the public hearing portion. If there's anyone here who would like to speak to this particular item, you can come on up.
I have a question about that.
Come on up.
It's not about Article 15, it's about the proposal.
Okay, so we've passed that item, and if you have any questions, we're happy to talk to you afterwards. But right now, this portion is only on this item, so but we'd love to talk to you after. So stick around.
I guess after Chandler presented that he wanted to have public comments on this, but there was no questions. How was that?
So there's no public comment on that. Not every item has public comment.
There will be. This goes into the future. Right. Discussion. When we actually start
spending.
So when we amend certain titles of the code by state law, we have to have what's called a public hearing. And so any land use issue, which is everything you found in Title 10,
requires a land use here. That happens in the planning commission, that happens in the city council. So if you live by the SC1 zone, you would have got the little postcard that says the city council is having a public hearing. They probably get so many of them, they just become white folks, but there are certain requirements that you have to put out. So there's a difference between public hearing and public comment. Public comment occurs at the very beginning of the meeting, and you can talk about anything you want in 3 minutes. Public hearing is more focused on time than it is being discussed. It's more germane to the topic. Yeah, we only do public hearings for Title 10 issues, as you are saying.
And budget.
And just as a matter budget. Of Robert's rules, we don't take questions during these council meetings. Even on a public comment, can comment, but we don't answer questions. Don't take questions.
So how do you get questions answered? If it's a public forum, I'm serious.
It's not necessarily, this portion of the meeting is not necessarily a question and answer period. So we have the public comment at the beginning. And if you want to sit around and ask this question, we're happy to answer any questions. But as she said, according to Robert's rules, the meeting is run where there's question and answer between the council and the media. And that's true for every government body. You can't go to a city council meeting or a school district meeting and ask a question either. So it's a public comment period, and then we can say after and ask those questions. We could do that, but it's just not played.
You want to put on the record, so it's, you
know. That
so in fact, on this, let me read an email.
Yeah, I was going to mention that.
We have an email from a resident that led us by this item, and I will share that email. We'll share it with the planning commission. This is addressed to the planning commission. I informed her that I was sending it to the city council following the planning commission. So let me read it. It's from Sherry Condi, 4221 West Oak Road North. She says, I'm right to recommend that we don't amend our current commercial zone landscape code. When too much rain falls and the sun aggravates the heat of summer, how well we know these days. We've adopted our planning efforts to mitigate flood. Such are the needs for landscaping ordinances to reduce the risk of flooding from the urban asphalt extreme heat island plan. These strategies only work in a dispersed manner throughout the city. Much of the sun shines and the rain falls on every acre here. Belt enriching reduces green, softscape, or small fire retention assets in a particular area will decrease its protection from flooding. It will also increase the temperature at that area, leading to higher air conditioning costs and higher discomfort for customers and pedestrians outdoors at this location. Additional benefits for more commercial landscaping for better aesthetics and air quality, and it's important to maintain our current code. Patch of green somewhere else in Heritage Park, and we need to be in line for your program. So that was the comment that we received via email. And I addressed that in that she talks about flooding. Well, Mike is a developer, you can attest that when we do these projects, and the next item is the car wash. They take into effect their storm rate calculations in that they have to calculate their hardscape, and the 100-year flood, the 100-year rain that we received, maybe about to have one, but they have to be able to account for all that, maintain all of that rain for a certain period of time to take into effect flooding conditions. So I don't believe that a reduction in this type will increase flooding potential, because while the hardscape is decreased, that's still being calculated by an engineer to maintain certain storm rain capacity for that rainfall. And I honestly don't believe that a minor decrease in landscaping there will have the heat effects that dismisses. Although that Sherry, I think she's wonderful. I appreciate her comments and her involvement in the city. I really do.
And it's important to point out too, landscaping is important. Okay, there are no more questions or any other discussion. I will entertain a motion on this item. And remember that we're adding.
Can we add the language that applies only to the commercial zone? And then the planning commission has to have this second 23% removed from the code. Basically, what that says, it changes it from developer shell to term of square footage difference between 30% required landscaping and the proposed 23% landscaping plan, which is the proposed landscaping plan, because they may not be going to build again to 23%, maybe 26%. So it's just a process.
So, anyone want to make that?
I can do it. I make a motion that we approve ordinance, let's see, it's 7-20-2021A. Amending the Cedarville City Code, Title 10-6A-4, related to landscaping, SC1 commercial zone, subject to, well, we did say commercial zone, but also applicable to all commercial zones. What do you want there? And then to resume the 23% that was second, this is my second.
All right, thank you, Mr. Geddes. We have a motion made by Councilmember Geddes. May I have a second? I'll second. Councilmember Smith, Councilmember Geddes.
Aye.
Councilmember Smith?
Aye.
Councilmember Ellison?
Aye.
Thank you, that motion passes. We move on to item number 8. And this is a review and action in public hearing on Shiny Shell Car Wash, Grease Monkey, and Grease Monkey, located at 10002 North, 4800 West, in SC1 Commercial Zone.
Yes, thank you, Commissioner, to give their final recommendation for approval for the Shiny Shell Car Wash and Grease Monkey Oil Change located just south of the Hearts there in that property. It's south of Hearts, but the Taco Bell is one of the picture. So this is where Taco Bell is, this is the Hearts, and this is where the proposed location is. The plant itself started out on the very south end down by the Grand City Funeral Home and the 9 AF residents that are just adjacent to Sears. And there's a lot of concern about the noise. And that you've been into these types of car washes where they use these high power vacuums. You can see all the vacuum stations all around. They use these high power vacuums that generate quite a bit of noise. I went up to their location, it's up in Murray, and I took a decimeter and stood in between them. They have 3 vacuums there. Is that 3 or 4 vacuums? What are they called?
Producers. Actually, producers. Sorry. Okay. People call the arches vacuums.
Okay. Producers. Producers of noise. Yeah. They stood in the middle of those, and the decibel reading was about 90-95 decibels. And if this were where the producers were, they had homes that were literally right there. So just probably 30 feet away. But really nothing mitigating the landscaping. Walls, there's no fencing. But by the time I got up to the home, right up to the property line, the sound actually reduced to low 70s decibel reading, so it drops off quite precipitously. But their producers are located down here on this corner and then up here on this corner. So the nearest home is this one right here, but you can see that it's got a fence, it's got a road, and you got some landscaping, parking, grease monkey, more parking than the producer. So I felt like the sound had been addressed when we moved the site. So when we moved the site from down by the Lawrence Funeral Home up to near the Hearts, I felt like it was a better location in that there's just a better synergy with a gas station and a car wash and a oil change that this all is located right here.
I can't tell. Does that eliminate the need for the joint agreement between Parks and then, or is that still an open?
That's still an open. So there's 2 openings. There's this one right here. This dark line just indicates the property. It almost looks like it's a curve better.
I see. Yeah,
but it's actually the property. So you can see the turning lanes there, and yeah. There's 2 locations where cars are there and on the property.
And I know initially we talked about they were going to get yeah. They need to get a joint use agreement.
So, and in your packet, when we talked about that, there was a number of concerns that staff had in terms of this being approved. So let me go through those with us. First was when the David Weekly Home subdivision right here to the east came in, and when the Taco Bell came in, these roads were master planned but not in existence. And when a developer comes in with a project, the city requires them to do 50% of the road plus 10 feet. And so if you can imagine 4,700, David Weekly's obligation would be terminated somewhere in here, so you'd have half a street right here. We understand that 4,700 is going to be used by traffic, and we need 2 lanes of traffic. So at the time, the city spent money to improve the frontage all along their site here. So the first thing we need to do is reach an agreement on the improvements for the infrastructure along 990 North and 4,700 North. I spoke with representatives from Shiny Shell, and I think we've worked out an agreement, so the city's going to draft an agreement. This happens in two phases. There's this initial phase of reimbursements for the frontage on the Shiny Shell and Grease Monkey, what we pay right now, and then the frontage improvements for this future building site, which is directly behind the parks, what we pay when this one gets about some of that. So they're only incurring them. And I see this as a benefit to them in that they've got the advantage of these public improvements are already done, they're expected, they're approved, and they were done at $2019 dollars. So normally that's not a ton of inflation, but today's the age of actually. So we're going to work out an agreement on that. I'm going to work with our attorneys and draft that, and staff at the way this worked out. One other issue was the water rights. With the car wash, you can imagine that they use quite a bit of water. So they did not have the appropriate amount of water needs to be turned over. They produced 12 acre feet of water, but they purchased 12 acre feet of water that we turned over to the city. We just need to verify that that's an accurate thing. In this site, they actually recycle. They recycle 70% of their water on site and reuse it on the facility. So it's not just cycled straight, but it's treated and brought back to the facility. So we need the verification of the water rights. Councilor Guest, to your point, there will need to be I believe you sent that to me.
Yes.
The access agreement with Parks Gas Station to be able to access through this private access driveway. This one is their own, but these two need to be jointly accessed in the parks. There's some minor alterations to the landscaping plan.
So, sorry, go back up for a second. So, are that new parking stalls, like that's the Hearts trash bin, and those are all new?
These are existing.
Yeah.
These are new.
Okay. And are they coming on that next phase, or are you putting them in with this space?
This phase.
This phase right now. So you see, this is the property line, right? That's the property. This darker gray, that's going to be installed.
That's probably going to be.
Yeah, so you've got, well, let's talk about parking lots up there. You brought it up. You've got five stalls here at the north end. You've got another five stalls here at this far end. And then you've got a number of stalls, including the ADA, three stalls and the ADA stall here at this end. So this is really where you're going to park most of your workers. When I went up on site to their Murray location for the car wash, I typically have three employees working at a time, maybe four, but I saw this, that they do ask the employees to park in the bathroom stalls when they have community employees, so they will have employees come. I would encourage the employees to come use these stalls down in reverse, because these are going to be the hardest ones to get out of, so I would encourage them to use those ones first. But, so they do use the bathroom stalls for employee parking, and then so we talked about walkability in for a car wash. I don't know how many people walk to a car wash, but they can. So you have a sidewalk, you can access the property. So I guess if you're a worker, a local resident working here, you could walk to work. I would say most patrons of the car wash are going to arrive with you. Just a bunch. There's always an exception. I hesitate to say always, but you know. Maybe this kind of is appropriate. Alterations to the landscaping plan. I feel like these are very minor alterations to the landscaping plans, and we sent these to the developer for their consideration. But this tree, there's a tree right here on the corner. It's pulled out, and you remember that this pulls out onto 4700 West. This tree is too much in the line of sight, so if you turn to the right to look upcoming traffic, want that tree not gone but moved. So you'd like the planning commission wanted to see that tree. Maybe the new piece of four trees relocated so they're a little bit closer together. We don't lose a tree, we're just moved down. And then they have a pallet landscape schedule here. We just want to make sure we've sent them this feedback already that the schedule that they indicate on their plans comes from the SC1 code 10-6A. That is what the final two items, one is your standard, you know, we're still hammering out some of the differences in red lines with the engineer. And that's currently going on. I don't know if there's any major issues there, but on public safety, we have the public safety department, fire marshal review these plans, and there's a fire hydrant right here to the south of the building, there's a
fire hydrant over to the west. This side of the fire hydrant, that one is self-storage that they can access. But there's not a fire hydrant not close enough on this northwest side. So we're asking for the installation of the fire hydrant up here in this corner somewhere, so that they can put a fire behind any side of the building. Second, this was I know that their engineers are trying to work getting in touch with the fire marshal today on this item. But the fire marshal wanted to see this is a check-in point right here. This is where you go through and there's an automatic license plate reader. So it reads your license plate and it just pops up. But they wanted to see public access that's right here where the fire truck came in, they could come through and leave. So if they gated off, it would be open to the public, but it'd be an access point. That would be before this kiosk here. But the problem is there's a grade change here to here that makes that somewhat problematic. So we tasked their engineer and the fire marshal with coming up with a solution on resolving that. So there's ways out. That's good.
No offense to the fire department, but seriously, the fire department had a curb on the outside. They're just getting any closer to the building than they were.
I think it's a matter of getting the amount of backup that they have to bring that apparatus. If they had to bring that apparatus up here, it's being able to back up. Not having to back up that steel move forward through the site. I think that there's other solutions. I'll be in touch with the developers on how those conversations are going with the engineer and the fire marshal. See, that is the proposal. Are there any questions from council or council?
Any questions? Mine would just be if we did to approve what you mentioned, a few things that still need to be done. What would actually consider conditions?
So going to your list that's in the memo,
uh-huh.
Do you have that up?
Yeah.
It would be to reach an agreement on improvements for infrastructure, final verifications of water rights, no very close on that, alterations to the landscaping plan, approval by public safety, and approval by the final engineering review.
Okay, those are the only ones
that
you mentioned.
Yes. And they've made quite a bit of headway on most of them, so I'm fairly confident that we're just kind of that last mile of getting the last thing done.
Okay. Any further questions? I'll entertain a motion in a second.
There's a public hearing.
Oh, that's right. Thank you. There's a public hearing on the side. Okay, never mind. So I'll open it up now for public hearings. Anybody would like to speak to this particular item?
They are in fact, I can only suffice to say what I made.
What he already did? Okay. All right, so I'll make a motion to approve the final plans for the Shiny Shell Brief Monkey subdivision located at 10002 North, 4800 West, subject to the following conditions that were already mentioned. Okay. Thank you. I have a motion. Councilmember Smith, do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you. Second by Councilmember Ellison. Councilmember Gittes.
Aye.
Councilmember Smith. Aye. Councilmember Ellison.
Aye.
Thank you. That passes unanimously. So we'll move on then to congratulations. We're excited about the Shiny Shell.
Excited to be part of the community.
Yeah, that's going to be great. We look forward to that. Is there just like treats and stuff inside?
It's actually really cool.
Okay.
This is, I thought this was really awesome. They have a playground outside for kids.
Whoa.
They have, if you guys go into the facility, there's actually a squirt gun and kids can use the squirt cars as they're going through.
Oh, just kids or can?
Adults can use
it all the time.
Okay.
You pull up and there's the vacuum stations and they have the little wipes that you get. And there's also the cleaning bottles with rags. So you can, there's a whole gamut. I feel like it was very, I went up there and just looked and checked it out. It was very nice.
Don't forget the soda machine, the members lounge.
They also have free diet coke in the members lounge, which is going to save me a lot of money because I'm going to stop that.
Okay, you are excited about
it. So
all right, that's great. We're going to move on to item number 10, which is a discussion on decisions 21 citywide survey.
We need item number 9.
Oh, I turned too many pages. Let's go more. Okay, item number 9, review action on release of durability bond for gateway subdivision phase 1 and phase 2.
the Gateway subdivision is the Taco Bell and the self-storage. This says self-storage, but it's not just self-storage. But what happens is they bonded for their construction now. And in this case, they didn't want to record their plat, and state law allows them to not record their plat, but they can't sell off the pieces, right? But when they got close to having their bond done, they bonded for the remainder of what was outstanding. So we held that, and that's valued at 125% of the outstanding improvements. When those are inspected and done, we hold a bond, it's called a durability bond, for 10% for 1 year of the public cost of the public improvements. This includes sidewalks, curb gutter, asphalt, water lines, sewer lines, PI lines, and all the infrastructure that we're taking over. Once we've accepted it, we keep a watch on it for 1 year for 10% of that asset.
I thought the state made that 5.
5%? Not that I've seen.
Am I just remembering that wrong?
It used to be 20.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It used to be 20, and we were holding 20, and we felt we were out of the state, so we fixed that.
Okay.
But it is 10, unless it's changed, right? It's changed. It's a secret.
It's been too long to remember. I know it went in half.
It went in half. 20, ours is 20, went down to 10.
Okay, thank you.
So here, I'm just going to leave this up, but the public improvements are this 9980 North Public Road. It's not the infrastructure that's in here. There is a line that runs up and down through this private access driveway. And then along 4700, we've inspected it. Kevin's inspected it and is satisfied with the workmanship that happened down there. The two major issues that we have on these subdivisions, this phase one and phase two, which we talked about in self-storage, were the verifications that the water rights have been conveyed to the city. This is a significant amount of water rights in a subdivision. I received a report of conveyance from the state a little over a week ago. So that has been done. So they've turned over the water rights, that's the check that box. And the last part is the as-builts. And that means that they have to show us, like, here you're seeing, you're looking at Shiny Shell's approved plans, right? And they're going to construct it, but they're going to run into problems, and the construction is going to look a little different than what's approved. So they need to provide us a set of as-builts to show exactly where lines are, exactly where valves are, so that in 20 years, if we have to dig that road up, we know exactly where the line is. And I will say that we're a little sensitive to this right now, because on every city map, there is a line in 4600 West. There's a water line in 4600 West. You remember the Lone Peak Lost subdivision that they planned on tying into this water line that was a 10-inch water line, water main in 4600 West. Well, we dug open the road, and this is long before, I think this is on every single one of the city maps. We dug open that road, there's no water line. It's nowhere to be found. So we installed the water line, so we know it's there now. It's a 12-inch. But this is why as-builts are very critical. You know, we didn't get as-builts 20-some-odd years ago, and it led to a mistake that happened much further down the road. So we want to get as-builts, especially on those main items of infrastructure. So there were two items. There were the water changes, the water rights conveyance, and there was the as-builts. So really close. They've provided the as-builts. They've gotten some comments on the as-builts, and then we can shop those back, so they're correcting those. But I would recommend to the council that they approve the release of the durability bonds for Gateway Phase 1 and 2, subject to the as-built drawings being approved by the engineer.
Any
To make a motion that we approve the release of the variability bonds for Gateway Phase 1 and 2 subject to the as-built drawing.
Incorrect.
Thank you.
How was your trash collection? How was your
snowplow? How is administrative staff? How are the legislative officials? Regulatory mandates. But it allows us to kind of see the overall trend in the city, where maybe we're coming up short, or we misplaced our focus. In the past, the city's worked with Dan Jones to do a study that was statistically relevant. They would send out a survey with an email link, they would do phone calls, they'd do mailers, and they would knock doors. So it cost the city about $10,000 to do a survey. And we would gather this information and we look at it once, maybe twice, and then we say, that's nice. But it does give you a good idea of the pulse of the community, right? Then a few years ago, we did it again using a Qualtrics agreement. And in that case, we paid, I want to say it was like $5,000 or $6,000 for this year-long Qualtrics agreement. And it was less, but still, we took the survey. We got the same amount of results, and even the same type of results. I don't believe that they changed very much. But again, we looked at those results, and they were great. They were a great guiding document. They gave us a good sense of where the city was and where we needed to head. In this case, we didn't budget for a $2,000 survey. So I'm going to propose that we do it just through a survey. We use a cheap service that we send out an email. We use the same questions, it's most of the same questions we've used before, but we solicit feedback in that manner. And the reason being is that we've talked about it needing to be statistically relevant in the past. However, I don't feel like we use it in a way that the statistically relevant survey matters that much. We really use it in a way that we get, like I said, the pulse of the community. We want to know where the community stands on many issues. One of those issues that came up a few years ago was pool. In surveys in the past, we would ask, do you want a pool? And people would say, yes, we want a pool. And that was always the primary of this pool. You've heard from the residents, you want a pool. Well, was it 2018, 17, 18?
I think it was 18.
18. We asked the question, do you want a pool? But we framed the question in a manner that showed them a picture of the pool, an actual pool. We said, this is the estimated cost of this pool. This is what your property taxes would go up in order to pay for this pool. So they understood exactly what the impact of that pool would be on their property tax bill. And all of a sudden, people wanted to slide. So that's why we just scratched that hard work. And it's great. But it does give the council some really clear direction, but it also helps, it's also a tool that helps inform residents on maybe the implications of costs of varying services. So this came about because Councilmember Smith and I had a conversation about libraries. What do we do about libraries? Well, we have this library reimbursement that we offer as a service to the community. We will reimburse you $50 for the cost of your library fee in another community. And we looked at it, and as I recall, the numbers were that we out of $15,000 would be budgeted for in a year, only about $11,000 to $12,000 spent, vast majority going to Highland Library, a big chunk going to American Fork, a big chunk going to Pleasant Grove, and Bill Smith is going to Salt Lake and North. But that was the result. But we don't, we set aside $15,000, but it's not taken advantage of by everybody in the community. So the question was, if people really want a library, let's frame the question the same way. Let's say, here's a library, here's what it'll cost, what are you willing to pay for it? And if you see that a majority of the residents say, yes, we find this to have an intrinsic value in the community, we want to see a library, then that gives you some very clear direction. But it also lets them know exactly where they need to stand on library. So we talked about library questions, we talked about dog park questions, that seems to be another one that comes up quite frequently. But it's been 2 years, and so staff is seeking some direction from the council on, would you like us to proceed with another survey? Is this something that you
want? What a survey might cost us?
It'll be about $300.
Is it?
Yeah.
And we're on the cemetery, I know that's coming up a little bit.
Before we send it out, we'll have the council review all the questions.
Yeah, so it was a really great conversation that Chandler and I had, and that was kind of my point is, it's one thing to say, would you like a pool? I mean, if someone comes and offers me a pool with no strings attached, I might want a pool. But then if I tell me this is how much it's going to cost to put it in the backyard, this is how much it's going to cost to maintain it, those sorts of things. Those things need to be in our questions. And so that was my my interest in the survey. I happen to put on, just to your Hills chat room, and just for background, Cedar Hills chat room has about 1,000 people on it, and we have about 2,500 households. So we can get, some of those people don't live here, but it's a good, maybe half of the people that live here. And honestly, a lot of people are super active in what's going on. Not to say that other people aren't, but those are people we hear from the most. So I put on there about the dog park, and it was a really, really good discussion when my question was not, do you want a dog park, but where would you put the dog park? Who's going to pay for the dog park? How much should we spend on the dog park? Do we even want a dog park because Riverton almost closed and Draper has water issues and those sorts of things? So when you take the totality of that, do you still want a dog park? And I was actually really surprised at some of the answers. We had some good creative things that people put on there. We had a lot of people who don't want a dog park, like under any circumstance.
Dog owners.
Who were dog owners. Who were like, I don't want a dog park. They're gross. I would never go with them. I don't want a park used for that. I don't see any undeveloped land that we can use. So I love the surveys. I definitely want to hear what residents want, but I want them to understand what they're wanting. And so I think that when we ask those questions, we need to ask them in a way that doesn't sound like this is all free, this is all coming your way, and you need to have some education behind what you want from the city. We're a small veteran community. For us to have the sorts of things that Draper has, or that even Highland has, is not reasonable. That's not who we are. We're a little tiny community. That's why most people live here. We live up against the mountain. Those sorts of things. So I think the things that we want to appreciate about Cedar Hills are also sometimes going to be limitations on what we can do and what we can offer people. And so I would like to offer as much as we can to as many people as we can with compromises that help people. I know in the library, for example, there's a lot of people in our city who don't want the library, don't use the library, and they appreciate that they don't pay for a library. And so I think so far we've come up with a really good compromise. Could we tweak it? I've come up with some other ideas. I've talked to residents of other ideas. We totally could, but I think that that's what we try to do as a council, is come up with some real good compromises that help as many people as possible. We're not going to make everybody happy.
No, I agree.
Jim, I was just going to say that the park survey, we used SurveyMonkey. That was the one, that's what Insight Design used. And the example of the pools is, we took three different pools, Manti, Rexburg's pool, and Payson's pool. And so there was a $2 million pool, a $7 million pool, and a $10 million pool. And then we said, okay, this is how much it's going to cost. And I think the middle pool was the most popular, and there was 30% support to pay for it. So, yes, if I go look at the questions, I'll make sure that the financial component.
Thank you. So, if you're interested in this, as a staff, we can work on putting together a proposed survey, have you approve it, and put it out to the public.
It's just a discussion item, so are we in agreement for any staff to perform the survey?
Yes, for sure.
Great.
Good idea.
I use SurveyMonkey a lot, and it's been really beneficial. Yeah.
Okay.
One more item.
Yes, item number 11, discussion on water conservation and utilities.
Yeah, I wanted to give the council, this is just a discussion item, but I wanted to give the council kind of an update on our utility systems and kind of some of the major issues and projects that staff is looking at to look long-term in terms of being able to provide services to the community. So let me start with water production. We have three wells in the community. There's the Concord well, the Stampede's culinary well, and Heritage Park, we have the Hardy well, that's a culinary well, and then we have the Candy well, which is used with EI water. So we really have two culinary wells. Hardy well, it was constructed in 1967. It's an old well. It's an old irrigation well that we've upgraded over time, but what we've seen is a drawdown of significant proportions this year. When the city acquired that well, it was producing 1,300 gallons per minute. As of this morning, I had to change this because it's lower as of this morning.
600. So it's less than half of what it is.
Is that the one in Heritage?
That's the one in Heritage. And that, if you look at the static water levels of that well, it goes down in the summer as we draw down the water through the aquifer, and then through the spring, or through the fall, through the winter, it builds back up. But last 2 years, it hasn't built back up quite to what it normally does. So we're seeing further drawdowns and not as much recharge as we would like. There's two options here with production, is that we can go through the process of a well replacement, and that process takes about 1 to 2 years. And you have to have the replacement well within 100 feet of the well it's replacing, otherwise it's considered a new well. So you look at a radius around Heritage, around a Harvey well, there's really only land inside a Heritage Park that you can put that replacement well. One of the issues here that, and staff is not agreeing on all of these things, we've been bantering around these ideas for a few weeks, and we've been talking, we've had meetings with multiple engineering firms to kind of see where we should move. But in this case, we put a lot of money and equipment into upgrading and updating Harvey Well. So that originally when it was acquired by the city, it was just a soft start well, considering non-off switch, turned it on and pumps at that rate. Turn it off. We'll install what's called a variable frequency drive that you can change the flow, you can change how much you're pumping out of it. Back in 2015, we had a lot of reports of bubbles in the water, a lot of air was coming out being pumped out of the water. So there were issues with the well where we spent quite a bit of money to go in and refurbish that well and to redo that well so that it didn't produce that aeration. So there is an asset there. And I'm personally hesitant to walk away from it. I think that even at 600 gallons per minute, it will recharge. There are other wells in the area drawing down from the same aquifer. If you drive down here, you drive down Cedar Hills Drive, you'll pass two Pleasant Grove wells. So those two wells are so close to each other, they actually can't be on the same site. So there's multiple wells pulling from the same aquifer, so imagine multiple straws in the same drink. We just have to make sure that we're being very responsible with resources that we're giving. So I'm not convinced that a replacement well is the right way to go, but I do see the value in it in that the project is 1 to 2 years. And so if we have a problem with a well, we're back online with a better well in a short amount of time. A new well construction, that'll take 2 to 3 years, and the biggest headache with it, associated with it, is the protest period. So it goes out to every public water share holder and water user in the area that somebody's proposing a new well. And they have the ability, there's a protest period where they can file a protest with the state engineer's office to say we don't feel like this well is appropriate or should be considered or should be approved. And typically they defer to municipalities and they need to provide services to residents, but nonetheless you do have to go through this protest period. So you're looking at 2 to 3 years. We're heavily reliant on American Fork Water, as you can see that they put in a new brand new tank down there in the Mexican Gulf Course. They pull their water out of the canyon and pumped out and near the roundabout, we're the first customer off of their line. So we pull water in from American Fork. Well, American Fork has a lot of development that's occurring. So at some point they could come in and say, we need this water. So we're trying to say, okay, what are some solutions to not being so heavily relying on American Fork Water? And it's been years since that. So that's why we're looking at our production issues. But along with that, we have storage issues. We have two tanks in the city. One is 1.5 million gallons and one is 1 million gallons. In those tanks, we have to maintain a certain amount of water so that in the event of a fire, the fire department has enough water to fight the fire. So that's, we have to maintain an adequate fire storage. We are really close to the threshold where more development pushes us past the point where we don't have enough storage, right? So we're looking at a new tank. I've talked to a number of developers on the hillside here that are interested in putting homes up in this gap between Canyon Heights and Cedars East, and they're looking at putting these homes up there. And the higher up the homes go, the less likely it is that we, given our current water system, have the ability to pump water to their houses without major infrastructure improvements, storage among them.
The cost to develop a new well is, in today's dollars, estimated at $3 a gallon. So if you're building a 2 to 3 million gallon, or we would need a 2 to 3 million gallon.
$3 a foot.
What's the again?
$3 a foot. So how do you go to them? Yeah.
Oh, three. I'm saying tank.
I said well.
I mean tank.
Sorry. So we got a million gallon tanks to cost you 2 million.
Yes. So you're looking at some major water projects here that the city will need. The last item is PI meters. We talked about water conservation. This item is known as water conservation. We've talked about water conservation. We've put messages out to the community over years. We've done videos. We've done signs, little barometers showing how much water you should be using and how much water we are using, and nothing seems to work. We've asked the question raised in the public comment, well, what about golf and golf watering? Well, go look at our driving range. It's next to dead. We've basically stopped watering the driving range in order to save money. Golf hasn't been instructed to water 20% less. And as the residents were, as we evaluate our water resources and the reliability of our water resources, we said if we can get the golf course and the residents to water 20% less than they normally do, we'll be able to provide services through the rest of the year. The golf course has been really good. I appreciate your efforts. There've been some hiccups along the way, but they've done very well. But to change residential behavior on the water use, really the only thing that changes is weather. So in 2019, we had a really wet spring where it rained every day in April. And it was just all everything. We're trying to do hard work at the same time. If you look at the production and the usage at that month, it's extremely low. But then as soon as it dries out and starts getting hot again, it matches the exact same curves every other year. We had a wet August a few years ago, back in 2016, where again, it saw a drop in the usage, but it was weather related. So really, the only thing that really affects behavior in a significant manner is weather. So PI meters. The state requires cities to have a metering plan that goes in place and has the city metering their water by 2039. Is that correct here? As of 2019 or 2020, they start requiring the secondary meters on only construction.
2028.
So all new homes that are being built now have to have a secondary water meter. So Kevin has been meeting with some providers where we have a radio read system where we drive through the city and we read the radio frequencies and telling us what the meters are, the pulmonary system. There's software that we can purchase that will allow us to begin to install the infrastructure we would need to install secondary water meters. The proposal right now is, Kevin, feel free to jump in if I get this wrong.
Okay.
But it's $175,000, and it includes the software to read these meters. Does it include any hardware?
Yeah, it includes all the training, all the hardware we need. Upgrade our computer system we have now to be able to read these other meters. It also includes 1,000 meters that are part of the deal too, that we can put around the city and other areas and start educating the people in the city of how much water you're actually using before we actually start charging and building to your system. So some people will know that they're using, 3,000 gallons a night, and some people are using 100 gallons a night. They're being based on that. So it's more of an educational thing, but it's going to happen. The state's going to force us into doing it one way. It's better to be proactive than having to throw it aside, you guys.
How many connections do we have?
So 1,000 meters is a significant amount of
money. So where are we starting around $1 million, $1.5 million back in the day?
Well, yeah, they're still an expense. So I'll let me get to that.
Chairman, with some of these electronic meters, at least the Badger system, I don't know what system you're talking about. Some cities are using one that pressurized irrigation. These meters to see who is abusing the use of the water, the hours, and that sort of thing, and using it as a means to educate the individual water user. We know notice you watering between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. We're noticing that you've got 8,000 square feet and you're using five times the amount that some agricultural standards set you up to use. And it's been used as an educational and an enforcement tool.
Yes.
So, you know, if you're on the backside and you're abusing the system, some cities and some irrigation companies have established a civil fine or assessment program on abusers as the last resort, not the first resort.
No, both Kevin and Greg touched on it, but there has to be an educational element for residents, because where we have not metered, I mean, if you ask me how much air water I use in my home, I couldn't tell you, I didn't have a meter. I did install the smart meter that shuts off when it rains and shuts off when it's too windy, and I try to minimize my watering, but I don't know how much water I'm using. So a lot of cities, you know, Weber Basin, I believe, was the head to let out on this, is they installed secondary water meters a number of years ago. So there's been a while ago. But they put out in the bills that they still bill the same way, but what we would propose is that we create a tiered structure showing here's what you're going to pay if you continue to use as much water as you use. Right? So they can see on their bill, like, I use X amount of X amount of gallons of secondary water. This translates to X amount of dollars in my bill. So then they know. So if they're using too much, they can make the adjustments. And then you have to have a drop dead date when that tier rate goes into effect. And that's the educational element, is that you have to help them help themselves. You have to help them understand how much water they are using, and so they can dial back and have time to kind of move their systems into what the state recommends in terms of water. You have to remember that we live in a desert that doesn't naturally grow like this. So we have, like I said, very responsible with the resources that we have been allocated to us. In line with that, there are grants and there are public funds that are coming available. There's a WaterSmart grant that opens up next month for the secondary meters that staff is going to be working on applying for this grant for the state. And then second, the city is going to require funds through the American Rescue Plan Act. Those funds are supposed to be used specifically for culinary water projects and for fiber. But in this case, we see the culinary water projects as being really essential to the services of the community. Fiber's coming, but our culinary water issues, I believe, is going to take precedent. So that's what I wanted to present. Staff, is there anything I missed that you want to add?
Just, I mean, the main thing is that we're running pumps 24 hours a day, which we shouldn't be running 24 hours a day, because people just overuse it.
Okay. I was just going to say, we reached out to three engineering firms. The best, I was Dr. Provo, Shane Jones or Johnson or something, but they recommended both Bowen Collins and Hanson Allen Lewis, and we're also looking at Clorox that got the WaterSmart grant for Alpine. But we're going to ask what they recommend, what's best in the long-term for our city. They're going to develop our long-term plan. We have some hunches, but we want their recommendation.
Yes, they do. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I think for a long time we've talked about it a number of times, is the metering of the water at the customers, and while it could be used to reduce the amount of water, educate people on how much water they're using, as a supplier, the city, we know how much water we produce, how much water we put in the system. We are required every year to report to the state our usage and our loss. And without meters at the customer's end, we have no way of measuring what our water loss is. We speculate that we do have water loss. We're a new system. We have relatively low water loss compared to some communities, but we're confident there is some. But we don't have any way to recognize that or identify it without having some way to meter where that water's going. So it's beneficial on both ends.
Yeah.
This is just a discussion of the local questions.
Yes. Mike was saying, is this the total cost?
No, this is not the amount. To get back to Mike's question real quick. Mike, this isn't the total cost. This is just a startup package that we're looking at, just to get us kind of started into this process. There will be more costs for, of course, installing the meters, the labor to, you know, buy more meters. It's just a startup program, a promo we're looking at right now, just so it'll take that amount of money off of the amount where we go to finance something, $1,500,000 off it, which will save us in the long run.
Yeah, no, I understand. Just for the record, I have a meter. I don't know how I do on that, because I don't get any feedback, but.
Well, we have to actually manually go out and read those things.
No.
So if this puts in a system where we can automatically, and that's the same way that David
I'm probably the only one left with a meter on my.
They put it on samples.
Like 5 years ago.
Yeah.
I'm hoping to give everyone the opportunity to. Yeah, everyone needs another green box, like right there, why not?
All right, any questions? Any other questions? Thank you, staff, for all your helpful input on that. Appreciate that.
Okay. Wait, I have a good question. The money, the fund you're talking about, that's the infrastructure program.
Yes. So that the city's getting money directly from the government. I believe it's just about $1 million. Additionally, the state has made a large sum of money available for application, and that application is just out some information this morning to various emails to say, hey, here's the application process. So that's why we're thinking about this project right now in terms of. Well, there's money out there. We want to see if we can get that money and spend it in our community here.
So, in the 7.5 years I've been on the council, this has come up over the years, and which is good. It's a good discussion and everything, but it was always a lot of money and a lot of pushback. But we're not the first. We'd be the first city in the state to have it. I mean, like this partner was a for maybe the PI, there's a venue, I think here's a PI. I don't know. It's just, I think we always said the state's going to be pushing this eventually. You know, I was never a huge favorite of it, but we've never been in this severe of a drought either.
And the state is requiring us to have follow our plan for metering by 2039. I could actually see the state, it would not surprise me to see the state accelerate that deadline given the growth in the area and the limited resources that people are all tapping into. So
just for the record, historically we're always talking about the state giving us an unfunded mandate. Unless they can't mandate it, unless they provide a way to fund it.
Yes.
And so there's always been that pushback, but I think with the monies that may be coming in, I think might be coming on us, but if we can get those kind of money, it's probably not.
Yeah.
Because nobody cares until they have to pay for it.
Right. All the cities are looking at it. We're not even close to the audience. We're meeting for hiring today, and they've been talking about if it's going to be our grass or our trees. And they're just, you know, desperate. The rest of us are, and they're talking about grants for their meters, and everybody's moving in that direction. And to your point, if the state did decide to do it and do an unfunded mandate, they could and they would, and we have to pay for it as residents. I mean, it's just all there is to it. They're allowed to do unfunded mandates, and we still have to follow the law.
We derive our authority directly from the state,
yes.
So they can do that.
Okay. Any other comments? If not, I will accept the motion to adjourn. I'll make a motion to adjourn.
I'll second.